This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Welcome to day 13 of our continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh here on the 10th of February, 2023. Let's head to the courtroom for our first segment of coverage.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Day number 15, state's case. The last objection was sustained, and ladies and gentlemen, I want to remind you, when I sustain an objection, that means you're to disregard the question and any response. You may proceed.
Yes, sir, Your Honor. May it please the court. Mr. Tinsley, good morning.
Good morning.
Just to kind of reset the table from where we left off, you had testified about pursuing the case against the defendant over the boat wreck, right?
Correct.
And you had communicated to the defense that the defendant was going to have to pay personally, correct?
Correct.
Not just the insurance.
Correct. Correct.
And you had been told that the defendant was broke, correct?
That's correct.
And you had filed a motion to compel. Had you filed a motion to compel States 402 seeking to identify any bank accounts that he had?
In October of 2020.
Okay. Could I have the elbow, please? And the screen. David, if you could help. All right. I think one of the things that you had also testified to is that just generally COVID had kind of slowed things down in the court system?
Ultimately, yes.
And then you had had some health issues that you were dealing with as well, is that correct?
At some point, yes.
At some point in time, did a hearing in the boat case that would include a hearing on this motion to compel that's on the screen get scheduled?
It did.
And when did it initially get scheduled?
My recollection is it was set for May the 30th, 2021.
All right, and let me show you an exhibit real quick. I'm going to show you what's been marked as States 404 and see if you recognize this document.
I do.
All right, and what is that?
That is a communication about the hearing. It's actually about a status conference about the hearing that's going to be on May the 30th.
Okay. All right, and what was the date of that status conference going to be?
May the 7th, all right. 2021.
All right, and then look at the subject line on that and just take a look at that real quick.
Motions hearing May the 11th?
Yeah. Was okay. That the date or was it May 30th for the motions hearing? To your recollection?
To my recollection, it's May the 30th.
All right. But this email is related to that particular hearing, is that correct?
It's related to the hearing on my motion to compel and some other hearings, yes.
All right. At this point, Your Honor, I move to admit States 404, I believe, without additional objection.
No additional objection.
And is that the particular email we were just discussing?
It is. And you're correct, the hearing was May the 11th.
May the 11th?
Yeah.
Okay. Haven't seen that, that refreshes your recollection?
Yes.
We'll show you now what's been marked as States 405. And have a take a look at that and see if you recognize this.
I do.
All right, and tell me what this is, please.
It's an email from Judge Hall, who had been assigned the case, about the hearing. John Tiller, who was Alex's lawyer in the boat crash case, was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer about the same time, just before I found out I had cancer. And so he had a chemotherapy treatment that was going to run long the day of the hearing. He didn't always know when his treatments would be, but about a week before he would know. And so the hearing needed to be rescheduled to accommodate John's treatment.
All right. And just initially, when that request was made, what was the judge in that case's response?
The hearing would go forward as scheduled, and one of Alec's other lawyers could attend.
All right. So initially, the judge denied that continuous request. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And what happened after that that ultimately resulted in it being continued?
I sent an email. John Tiller was my friend, and I didn't object to continuing it. And then the judge had a status conference, and at that point, we continued the hearing until June the 10th.
In the course of this litigation, given that we were coming out of COVID, had the judge in that particular case been relatively aggressive in wanting to move this case forward, to your assessment?
The judge knew that I was in Florida receiving treatment and was accommodating that. So, he wasn't being aggressive at that time. It was when I was ready, and so I was back and we were ready.
And that's what led to this initial hearing, is that correct?
Correct.
But ultimately you agreed to let this thing be continued, correct?
I did.
All right. Your Honor, this time I'd offer State 405 into evidence.
No additional objection.
Submit it.
And down at the bottom of this email chain, what's the date on that? Can you read there on your screen? I need to bring it back to you.
May 5th, 2021.
And that's a communication from whom?
That's from John Tiller to Judge Hall.
All right.
And that's relaying the need for the postponement for the chemotherapy treatment.
All right. And then there were the communications from you related to that. Is that correct? Well, let me go right here. This is the response right there. Is that correct, from Judge Hall?
That's the initial response, that he intended to go forward with the hearing as scheduled, and that Mr. Condon from the same firm could handle it.
Right. Show you now what's been marked as States 406 and see if you recognize this particular document.
I do.
All right. And what is this? Tell the jury what this is, please.
That's an email from John Tiller. So after the email that's on the screen saying I intend to go forward, John Tiller sent another email explaining a little more detail what's going on, and that he had I believe it says he had spoken to me and I had agreed. They were my motions. There were some other motions, but when it's your motion, you can agree to continue it if a party wants it continued and you don't object. And so that's what that's doing, is trying to get the judge to not go forward with the May the 11th date.
All right, Your Honor, this time I'd offer States 406 in evidence.
No additional objection.
Submit it.
All right, and the date on that particular email is?
May the 6th, 2021.
Did the judge ultimately, though, based on this series of emails, granted the continuance on this motions hearing, correct?
Well, he gave us a status conference in which we did by video, and ultimately he agreed.
Okay. And what day was the motions hearing that included the motion to compel rescheduled for?
June 10th, 2021.
Going back to States 402, one of the matters that was on the table to be heard would have been your attempt to get compelled responses to this interrogatory from the defendant, correct?
That's correct.
Seeking identification of his bank accounts.
That's correct.
You remember what day of the week, June the 10th, 2021, would have been?
I believe it's a Thursday.
How'd you hear about the murder of Maggie and Paul?
I got a phone call sometime in the middle of the night, 11:30, after my recollection.
And that was on June 7th, 2021?
That's right.
Into June 8th, 2021?
I think I heard it's still June 7th when I hear about it, but yes. Yeah.
On June 8th, 2021, did you have any conversations with any of the lawyers involved in the boat case or any communications?
I believe so. I think that it was more of there wasn't a whole lot of consideration to be given to the fact that the hearing wasn't going to go forward. It was sort of shock and horror of what had happened, and nobody really knew what to do in the moment.
Of course, that hearing's not going forward after this,
It did not.
Show you what's been marked as States 407 and see if you recognize that particular document.
I do. This is an email from Judge Hall's law clerk. Judge Hall's over the boat crash case to me and the lawyer for Parker's, as well as about the fact that the hearing's not going forward.
Your Honor, this time I'd offer States 407.
No objection.
Say admit it.
What's the date of that email?
June 8th, 2021.
At what time?
4:24 p.m. I think there's an email from John Tiller that precedes this one that morning, but.
But ultimately, there were communications the following day that obviously we're not going forward with this hearing on the motion to compel, correct?
Yeah, pretty much immediately.
And at that period of time, was there any date set in the wake of all of this for it to be reheard?
There was not.
In the wake of the murders, did you generally understand or have an idea of at least what had happened to Maggie and Paul, how they had been killed?
I did.
Just from media reports and the rest of it?
That's right.
And did that have any effect, that tragedy of their deaths, did that have any effect on your assessment of the boat case and how everything fit together if things were how they initially appeared?
It would have affected, I mean, yes, it did, and it would have ended the case.
It would have ended the case against who?
Against Alex Murdoch.
And explain that to the jury. Why? What had changed after this terrible tragedy?
Well, when you have a civil case, nice people get good verdicts, okay, just generally speaking. Yes, sir. Nice people get good verdicts. You really have to motivate a jury to want to help somebody in a civil case. And so if you compared, say, Attila the Hun with some sweet grandmother, who gets a better result? It's the sweet grandmother. If Alec is the victim of a vigilante, nobody's gonna hold him accountable. Doesn't make any difference what he did or how clearly what he did contributed. The case would be over against Alec. And so initially, it could have been over. It appeared that it was going to be over against Alec, because I had other defendants. I had Parker's convenience store that clearly violated its rules, and so you wouldn't want a very sympathetic person in your case when you have somebody who clearly violated the rules and caused this tragedy. So it would have been over against him.
The sympathies of the case had changed if Alec had truly been, his family had been the victim of some vigilante or something like that.
The sympathies would have changed if that had been true.
And assessing those sympathies and those emotions in a case like this is what you do as a plaintiff's lawyer, is that correct?
It's what we try to do.
And it's what Alec Murdoch used to do as well when he was a plaintiff's lawyer.
I think he was good at reading people and knowing what made them tick.
Thank you, Mr. Tinsley. Nothing further at this time. Please answer any questions the defense may have.
Thank you.
Mr. Barber.
Good morning, Mr. Tinsley.
Good morning.
Maybe just start asking a couple of questions that I think are just some things that we could agree on before maybe getting to some other things. Was there any life insurance for Maggie or Paul?
I don't believe there was any life insurance on anybody, including Alec.
And if this motion's hearing, which was not just the motion compelled, it was other motions, correct? On June the 10th.
Yeah, there were some other motions.
And if that hearing had gone forward, at least for the motion to compel, this would have been another step in a process, right? In other words, I believe it was your previous testimony. I think it's fair to say that there wouldn't have been an explosion on June the 10th. That this would have been another step, but it wasn't the end point.
So what happens?
Is that correct, sir? Yes or no? Am I misstating your testimony? There wouldn't have been an explosion on June the 10th.
You're jumping around, so it's hard for me to follow.
I apologize.
Well, if you let me finish.
No,
Your Honor, I would like to ask the witness to be allowed to finish his answer to one of those questions, and I object to the form of the question.
Pose one question.
Yes, Your Honor. Did you previously testify, I think that it's fair to say there wouldn't have been an explosion on June the 10th?
I'm sorry, yes, you were looking down. I couldn't hear what you said.
I'm sorry, I was reading it. I think it's fair to say that there wouldn't have been an explosion on June the 10th. Quote, was that did you testify? Did those words come from that stand when you previously testified? Yes or no?
I'm not trying to give you a hard time. You looked down again and I could not understand what you said.
I apologize for that. I'll hold it up. I'm just trying to read it accurately. I think it's fair to say that there wouldn't have been an explosion on June the 10th. Yes or no? Was that your testimony previously? Just yes or no.
It's possible. You're trying to turn it into something. It's not, but I probably said words to that effect.
Okay. No further questions, Your Honor.
Any redirect?
You're asked about the motion to compel being another step in the process. Is that correct?
It was a way to put pressure on Alec. Okay.
But if after that hearing happens and an order granting a motion to compel have been issued, that starts a process that's going to run its course. Is that correct?
Objection, pleading.
If a order is, I'm sorry, I'll rephrase that. If a order to compel is granted, tell us about the process that happens after that as it relates to your specific interrogatory we've talked about here.
Sure. The process starts on Alec's side way before. If you look at those exhibits that they marked the email, you'll see Danny Henderson. Again, Danny Henderson was his personal lawyer. Danny Henderson is also a shareholder in the firm. Danny Henderson is reviewing every single document. That's how meticulous Danny Henderson is. He reviews all of the account information before I get it. And nobody knows better what Alec's making than Danny Henderson. I mean, you'll see all these checks going out and all these payments being made, and Danny Henderson would have known. So the explosion.
Honor, object, Your Honor. Objection.
Basis for the objection.
Foundation.
Speculation.
Response.
Speaking of
response to the objection,
he has testified as to the fact of his interactions with that individual who actually brought him insurance documents to review. I think he has a basis to know.
Foundation and your response to the objection.
I believe he has sufficient foundation to address that from his personal knowledge, Your Honor.
Overrule the objection. You may answer.
Thank you, Your Honor. For instance, I had subpoenaed the phone records, not only Alec's, his father's, but we also had John Marvin, Alec's brother's phone records. Danny reviewed those records for a long time before I could get my hands on them. Danny was involved in everything. He was at every hearing. He was at every deposition. He was intimately involved in every aspect of the case.
Thank you. if an order to compel is issued, what was going to be your next step if you had an identification of accounts by the defendant?
Subpoena those accounts.
And if those accounts are subpoenaed, can potentially people move to quash those?
They could move to quash, but Danny Henderson would have looked at the documents in anticipation that I could get them.
I sustain the objection.
If motions to quash had been filed, though, you could have continued to seek that and there would have been further hearings. Is that correct?
I would have continued.
Objection. Sustain. That's the leading.
What would have happened if motions to quash were filed as to any subpoenas you issued to it for the specific information about the defendant's accounts?
I would have continued to push. We would have continued to argue about it.
Would have a process been put in motion, though, that was going to conclusion if an order had been issued on June 10th, 2021?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Nothing further.
Anything further?
No, Your Honor.
I step down.
Thank you.
The next witness.
May it please the court.
Yes, sir.
Your Honor, this time the state of South Carolina calls Ms. Blanca Simpson.
My name is Blanca Turrubiate hyphen Simpson, T-U-R-R-U-B-I-A-T-E hyphen S-I-M-P-S-O-N.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Is this difficult for you to be here today?
Yes, sir, it is.
Will you please tell the ladies and gentlemen of this jury, Ms. Simpson, about yourself, where you're from, your family if you want to, and just kind of what you've been doing in life leading up to today, generally, please?
Yes, sir. I'm originally from Brownsville, Texas. I joined the military at the age of 17. I was in Norfolk, Virginia for almost 9.5 years. I was stationed on the USS Puget Sound, USS Shenandoah, Naval Air Station Oceana right before I left.
What'd you do there?
Heavy equipment operator.
Okay.
And my husband was also a heavy equipment operator. We were both in the same field. We decided that the military was just not gonna be good environment for raising children, so we made a decision. Instead of moving to Texas, we moved to South Carolina, where he was from. And we have 5 children, 34, 31, 23, 21, and a 17-year-old that are all been raised down here in South Carolina.
Any of them still at home?
Yes, sir, 17-year-old.
Where was your husband from? You said he moved back home. Where was he from?
My husband's originally from Gifford, South Carolina.
Say it again.
Gifford, South Carolina.
Okay. And what does he do?
He's a police officer for Hampton.
When you came to South Carolina, you'd never been here before, correct?
No, sir.
Okay. What did you do when you got here, besides the hardest job in the world being a mom and raising kids? What else did you do?
When we moved here, we had enough leave built that we didn't have to work for almost 2 months. So I went to, after about a week, I kind of got bored because I'm used to having hands-on doing something. So I went to the local Piggly Wiggly store in town, and I asked the, I didn't know he was the owner at the time. I realized he was the owner after, if I could get a job because I was bored. And
how many kids do you have?
I have five.
Okay.
But I only had the two oldest ones okay. at that time. And so he said the only job he had was a stocker, and I actually had no idea what that meant because I had just graduated high school and went in the military, so I didn't know. But I told him I would take it as long as it would get me out of the house for a little bit. So I took that job, and then within a week, I got a call from another job that I had put in where it was brazing or welding at Scotsman, which is in Allendale County. And I figured, well, it offers benefits, and it would be better transition for the kids, dental, you know, that sort of thing. So I went there. After about 2 weeks, another job called me and had better dental medical benefits for my kids. So that was the first time I ever, well, I went to work for the South Carolina Department of Corrections. I opened up Ridgeland Correctional Institution. I was the first class to graduate from Ridgeland Correctional Institution. I worked my way up from correctional officer to sergeant. I managed the outside details and the road crew on the interstate. Also, a crew that would go out to Hunting Island for maintenance to assist with the park rangers. In 2001, I was offered a job at the Federal Bureau of Prisons, and I accepted the job. So I left Ridgeland Correctional Institution, went to work for FCI Estill, Federal Correctional Institution, Estill, South Carolina, where I stayed until 2007. My job, basically, I started back from the bottom as a correctional officer, and before my year's up, I got promoted to the Special Investigative Support to tech office, where I was responsible for managing, producing reports, weekly reports, and also profiling the Hispanic gangs, because there was not a lot of staff members that were bilingual. So my job basically became profiling, interviewing, and associating members, the inmate population, with gangs.
And how long did you do that?
From 2001 to 2007.
Not that anybody cares, but is that when I first met you?
Yes, sir.
Did you help me arrange a meeting with a prisoner I need to interview?
Yes, sir.
And why did you leave that job?
Just burned. When you're the only one of the only ones in the office that's bilingual, and you're constantly getting called out for different incidents dealing with a Hispanic population that had grown up quite a bit from the time I got there, and still having to do your daily duties in the office, and nobody's helping you, you tend to burn out pretty quick. So
if an incident,
I made a decision to leave.
So if an incident happened when they needed a translator,
I had to stop what I was doing and respond to whatever incident dealing with the Hispanic inmates.
What did you do after that?
I went into real estate for a little bit, which was not so good because that's when the market crashed.
And again, for the jury's edification, what year is this when you quit the prison?
2007.
Okay. And you're living where?
In Brunson.
I'm sorry?
Brunson.
So how long did you stay in real estate?
Maybe about a year and a half.
Your family's grown at this point, I presume?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And did there come a point that you met the defendant, Alex Murdoch?
Yes, sir.
Can you tell them how that happened? Tell the ladies and gentlemen how that transpired.
When I first moved to Gifford with my husband, like I said, I was bored, so I went to work at the grocery store. At the grocery store, and during the time that I moved, there was not a lot of Hispanic families living in that area. It has since grown in the years. I met a lady who I befriended. You know, she was Hispanic. And we started talking because she was the only other Hispanic person that I had actually seen in the area. So we started talking back and forth, and it was nice to speak in your native tongue with somebody. Her son had an accident at the school on his way after school, walking to the car, and he had gotten hurt. One of the ladies that worked at the school had recommended that she use an attorney from Walterboro. And a couple of months had gone by, and I noticed that she was under a lot of stress. And as I talked to her, she said, "I just have to get all these documents. I don't understand." She spoke English, but it was very broken English. So she was having a difficult time explaining what she needed for the attorney. So I told her, I said, "I'm gonna find you an attorney. I'll look around," I said, "and we'll go ahead and fire that attorney and hire you a new one." And, because we didn't want the statute of limitations to run out on her case. So at that point, I started looking around, and I happened to walk into the law firm. And it was the old offices where I met Alex.
Just walked in, and that's where you met the defendant, Alex Murdaugh?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and you were trying to assist this individual who was having trouble communicating with her prior attorney. Don't mention whoever that attorney was, but you helped her get a new attorney.
Yes, sir.
Did you help with that case, that particular case with this friend?
Yes, sir. He told me he would take the case.
Who is he?
Who's Alex told me he would take the case as long as I translate it and help him with the details. Because he didn't have anybody in the office that was bilingual, and I agreed.
You were a hot commodity, weren't you? I mean, there was a need for translating.
Yes, sir.
So you helped with that case?
Yes, sir, I did.
Did you assist in other cases with
Yes, sir, I did. At times, Alec would call me and ask him if I could assist in translating or when there were accidents and the folks were injured, and if they did not speak the English language, he would ask me to translate.
And were you getting paid for this service?
Yes, sir. It wasn't a set fee. It was just depending on the case, you know, whatever I did, whether it was to get him signed up with a law firm, basically, you know, or if I had any type of... In the Hispanic community, when you are in trouble or you're in need of something, and a lot of times those accidents, when they happen in the area, they are not from here. The language barrier is a big thing for them. So my instinct was more to make sure that they were well accommodated and they whatever they needed. So sometimes he would reimburse me for my out-of-pocket whenever I help the individuals, you know, who were in the accident.
And that went on for a period of time when you were assisting either Alex Murdaugh or the law firm, is that correct?
Yes, sir. Okay.
Did that change into a caregiver, if you will, or respectfully, I don't mean housekeeper or whatever term you'd like to call it, for Maggie Murdaugh?
Yes, sir. Alex had called me and said Maggie was looking for a person to help her in the home. And at that point, real estate wasn't really doing much for me. And so I told him I couldn't find anybody. I had asked around. And at that point, I told him, I said, "Well, I'll help her." And he was like, "Are you sure?" I was like, "Yeah, I'll help her." I said, "It's no big deal to me. It's honest work." So I said that I would help her.
You were clearly qualified.
Yes, sir.
So what did you start doing for either the Murdaughs or Maggie Murdaugh?
I started helping the other ladies in the house with the cleaning, with running errands, running to the bank for her, whatever she needed me to do.
And when did that start, Ms. Blanc?
In 2007.
Okay. And were the two young children, or the two children, Paul and Buster Murdaugh, were they younger at the
Obviously, they were younger.
Yes, sir, they were young.
And would you have interaction with them and or Alex Murdaugh during this time period?
Yes, sir.
How often were you working for the Murdaughs?
At that point, it was maybe every other day, depending on how often she needed me.
And where was that? Where specifically were you working? Where was their house?
At the house on Holly Street in Hampton.
Okay. How long did that go on before you stopped? And tell them why you stopped.
I worked there with them on and off, I shouldn't say that. Every 2 to 3 days, you know, or it wasn't a daily thing at that point. Then I did go probably about maybe, I can't recall whether it was a few months later or a couple weeks later. There was an incident at the house, and somebody had tried to burn the house. So that's when I actually went and started helping her more full time, because she had to go through a lot of the damages and all that. I helped her document a lot of whatever damages were done from the diesel and stuff that was spilt all throughout the house by the individual.
And maybe I wasn't clear in my question. Did there come a point where you had some health issues?
Yes, sir. At one point, I suffered a stroke and I had to stop working and go through rehab for a while.
And what year was that?
Fifteen, 17 or 18 maybe? Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
So prior to your stroke and you had to go to rehab, how long did you work for the Murdaughs?
There was a few years by then.
How long were you out after you had your stroke, Blanca?
Maybe almost 4 years.
Did there come a point where you went back and started working with Alex, with the Murdaugh family?
Yes, sir.
And tell these folks when that was.
Shortly after the boating accident, I reached out to Alex and Maggie, and I told them if they needed anything that they could call on me. And at that point, Maggie said that she would like for me to come back if I was able to. So I told her I would. At that point, I was feeling better, so I told her that I would go back. And once I went back, it was like I actually never left.
I was just informed the stroke was in 2015, not 2017.
Yes,
I apologize.
Yes, sir.
So after your recovery, you started working and actually called them, the Murdaugh family, and said, if y'all need anything.
If y'all need anything, you know, I'm here.
And I don't think anybody will dispute that was in February of 2019.
Yes, sir.
Time period.
Yes, sir.
So when you went back to work with the family after the boating accident, tell these folks, what were your duties then? What was your job?
I started right back at the same thing. I was helping with the cleaning. I was helping running errands. I would cash checks. I would, and what I say by cashing checks for Maggie, sometimes she didn't have time or she was busy doing other things, so she would send me to the bank to cash checks to pay the people that she had working around the house. The maintenance line, you know, that sort of thing, whatever she was doing around the house.
And where were they living, the Murdaugh family, at this point in 2019?
Both places.
Okay, and tell the folks where both places?
Moselle and Hampton.
So you're working at both residences?
Yes, sir, both.
And did there come a time where they moved exclusively for the primary residence to... Where was their primary residence?
Their primary residence was Holly Street, and once they sold the house, they moved straight into Moselle full time.
Well, We hadn't heard much about Maggie, and I'm limited what I can say in a murder case, but did y'all get fairly close?
Yes, sir.
And when you had quit working for her and you had your stroke, did you ever see her during that time period when you weren't working for her?
Yes, sir. Maggie would, I would see her in town, and she would often signal me to pull over. So we just used to stop sometimes and just talk and see how things were going at the local CVS.
Just to catch up?
Just to catch up and see how everybody was doing.
And prior, when you were working, and after, would you, and I'm not asking you to say what, but y'all got close and would talk personal things?
Yes, sir.
I'd like for you to go back in your mind now and take this jury back to June 7th, 2021.
Yes, sir.
You were working there for the Murdahls then?
Yes, sir.
That's a Monday. Do we all know that, June 7th?
Yes, sir.
When had you worked prior to that? At the Moselle property for them?
Friday.
And at that point, had you seen, what family members did you see at Moselle on Friday, which would have been the June 4th of 2021? Do you remember?
Paul.
Okay. And what was your interaction with Paul that day?
Paul walked through the door, his usual self. I was walking out of the laundry room, coming into the kitchen, and Paul came in the front door, and he was holding a laundry basket full of clothes. And as he was approaching me, he saw me, and he said, "What's up, Ms. B?" And I just looked at him. I said, "Boy," I said, "if you got all them dirty clothes and you want me to take care of that," I said, "I'm getting ready to leave." He's like, "Oh, come on, Ms. B. You can help me out." He said, "I need them for the weekend." He said, I said, "Well, just pull a couple of them out, what you need, and I'll take care of it." And I ended up staying late to make sure that he had his clothing ready for the weekend.
So did you wash the clothes for the entire family? Was that part of your...
Yes, sir, I did.
And did Paul leave that Friday?
I saw him leave. I don't know whether he was actually gone for the weekend or if he was still.
Did you ever see him again?
No, sir.
Did you have regular hours in June of 2021 that you worked at Moselle for the Murdahl family?
They weren't really set hours. Maggie was pretty, she was just easygoing. If I had stuff to do, if I had stuff to take care of, she wasn't really too keen on any specific hours. So, you know, if I had a doctor's appointment or if I had anything, she'd be like, okay, no. Her main comment to me always was no worries.
No worries.
No worries.
Well, June 7th specifically, were you scheduled to work at Moselle?
Yes, sir.
And did you have contact with Miss Maggie Murdahl sometime prior to getting to Moselle that morning?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And I think it's in evidence, but tell these folks what contact you had with her.
She she texted me and asked me if I could stop at the grocery store on my way to Moselle because Alex wanted some Capri Suns.
Wanted some what?
Capri Suns.
Okay.
And she said apple, and I believe she said pineapple first, and then she came back with another text and said, no, he wants orange, I believe that's what he said. That's what the text said. I'm not.
And did you try to get some orange Capri Suns?
Yes.
Where'd you go?
I went to the Food Lion.
And were you successful in your search for Orange Capri Suns?
No, sir.
I'll show you what's marked States 54, Spocker. Excuse me, Defenders 54, for the record. Did you have any other texts with Miss Maggie before you got to Mazzell?
Yes, Maggie told me she had to go to a doctor's appointment, and she said that in the text, Maggie said, Alec wants me to come home, and she said, and in a phone conversation, she told me, she said, I left some food in the refrigerator. Is there any way that you can cook? Paul likes the way you cook. So she said, because I don't think I'll be back in time. So I said, yeah, sure. I said, I'll do it. So it was nothing. I finished what I was doing, and then I started cooking, making sure the meal was ready for when Paul and they arrived at home. Well, that afternoon. And we had another conversation on the phone where she told me, she said, Alec wants me to come home. And she kind of sounded like she didn't want to come home. Because she really liked being at Edisto. And they had a lot of work that was going on, and she was trying to make sure everything was ready for the 4th of July gathering that she was planning. So she was very detail orientated, so she wanted everything perfect. So she was kind of, she sounded like she was a little disappointed. And then she said, well, Alec asked Paul to come home too, because he's got to fix the mess up out there that that CB had done.
That CB wrote?
Yes, sir. And he said Alec had told Paul to come and fix it because they were planning on having a hunt that weekend, so he wanted everything ready and good to go.
So he'd ask Maggie to come, and then he had asked Alex to come.
That's what
Paul to come.
Paul, that's what Maggie told me over the phone.
And looking at Defendant's 54, can you read that? Text?
He said, thank you. I'm waiting at doctor. Alex wants me to come home. I had to leave. Door open at Edisto, but trust Mexicans to shut and lock for me. His dad is back in the hospital. The last doctor claims not cancer, it's pneumonia. And then she's got some emojis. She said, Alec is about to die. Hope he doesn't go down there to sleep. Needs to take care of himself as well.
And when she said, I trust the Mexicans to leave the door open, that didn't bother you?
No, sir.
Okay. When she said, I guess my question is, you said you didn't think she wanted to.
Mr. Meadows, you're standing in front of the jurors.
Mm-hmm. I apologize. When you had just testified you didn't think she wanted to come home, was work being done at Edisto?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And did she like being at Edisto?
Yes, sir, she did.
And when would she stay at Edisto?
Any chance she had.
Okay. Where was a time of year that she liked being there more than other times?
Yes, sir. Come around spring, summer, she preferred to be in Edisto.
And I guess, was she at Edisto the night, Sunday night, do you know? Where was she Sunday night?
I'm not sure.
All speculation, unless she knows.
She can answer if she knows.
I'm not sure.
Thank you. Were you on schedule June 7th time-wise? Were you running late? Were you? What time were you supposed to be there?
I didn't have a set time to be there.
After you and Maggie talked and texted, did you go to Moselle?
Yes, I did.
And when you got there, was Maggie there?
No, sir. She had just left.
Was Paul there?
No.
Was defendant Alex Murdaugh there?
Yes, he was.
Okay. When you walked in the house, was he up?
No, sir. He was in bed.
He was in bed. Based on the time you spent there and your experience with the defendant Alex Murdaugh, was he a morning person?
No, sir.
No. How long were you there working before you saw Alex Murdaugh that morning on June 7th of 21?
Probably a couple hours.
Okay. And can you tell these folks, did there come a point that morning where he left the house? Alex Murdaugh, did he leave and go to work or
Yes,
wherever?
He did.
Okay. And can you tell them what he was wearing, Alex Murdaugh, best of your memory, when he left Moselle?
He had a pair of khaki pants, a greenish, I call it seafoam color, polo shirt, and he put a sports coat, a blue sports coat over it. And he put his shoes on, which were usually right there next to a dresser that they had right there in the living room area. That's where his shoes used to go right there, so he just used to kind of slide his shoes on his way out the door.
Do you remember what type of shoes he had on June 7th, 2021, when he left?
His regular work shoes, the brown, there was a pair of brown leather shoes.
Was it a long sleeve shirt or a short sleeve shirt he left on?
The polo's a short sleeve shirt.
And staying out of everybody's view, do you remember anything specifically about that shirt?
As he put his coat on, he was putting his shoes on and he was putting his coat on. And he was getting ready to walk out. He turned around and I said, Alec, I said, hold on a minute. I said, your collar's sticking up. So he turned around and I fixed his collar inside his jacket because one collar was sticking up.
So you actually helped, I'm sorry, but you helped move his shirt?
Yeah, yes, I did.
And you said it was a long or short sleeve, I'm sorry.
That polo is a short sleeve.
And did it have buttons on part of it or do you know?
Just from here to here.
And was it a blue blazer put on top of it?
It was a dark color.
Did he put a tie on? He didn't have a tie with that on.
No, sir.
Where's ties anymore? Now, Ms. Maggie had asked you to fix dinner for the family. Did you do that?
I did.
Can you tell them what you make?
She called it steak burger, but it's cube steak and gravy, some white rice, and some green beans.
You're a good cook, aren't you?
Yes, sir.
All right. Did you see or talk to Maggie ever again after this text or this phone call?
Before I left Moselle, I texted her and I said the dinner was on the, I believe I texted to the effect that I left dinner on the stove for them. And I can't really remember the text, but I did text her and let her know that the dinner was ready and that I was leaving.
And you said one of her phrases she used is no worries. Had she said that to you that day?
Yes.
When was that? It doesn't matter.
I can't remember.
You got a family of your own, right?
Yes, sir.
When you left Moselle, what did you do?
Pick up my son at school.
Okay. And your husband's working?
Yes, sir.
Law enforcement?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And when you got home that night, did anybody call you that night?
No.
When did you hear about the murder at Moselle of Paul
and Maggie Murdoch?
The next morning when I was getting ready to go out there.
The next morning?
Yes, sir.
Okay. How did you hear?
Alex called me.
And what did he tell you?
He didn't call, he called you the next morning?
He called me early the next morning. Okay.
And what did he say to you?
He sounded shaky on the phone. You could tell he was, his voice sounded really shaky. He said, B, they're gone. They're gone. And that my initial thought was, did she go back to Edisto? That thought didn't cross my mind that he meant that they were dead at that time.
You just didn't comprehend what was going on?
No, sir, I did not. So he told me again, he said, no, B, they're dead. And at that point, I don't remember because I believe I dropped the phone. My husband got the phone. I don't remember after that.
You literally dropped the phone?
Yes.
And did your husband get on the phone?
I don't remember. I don't remember. All I remember is when he said that they were dead. I dropped the phone. And I believe I said, I'll be right over.
The defendant Alex Murdoch tell you which way to go when you got to the house?
He said him and Buster were at Almeda, so I told him I was going to Almeda. You know, I wanted to make sure they were okay, so I went from my house to Almeda. And then when I got ready to leave Almeda, he said, well, when you go to the house, go in the front because there's a lot of sled agents by the kennels. You can't go in that way. And he said, just try to straighten up the way Maggie liked everything. You know, in the house, he said, you knew her the best. He said, you know how she likes stuff. So I did. I went to the house.
So you went to
I went into Moselle.
You went to Almeda to start with?
Yes, I did. To check on my Buster and Alec.
To comfort him?
Yes, sir.
And at his request, you went to Moselle to start cleaning up and getting the house in order?
Yes, sir. He said there was going to be people probably stopping by and bringing food and stuff. He said, I just want the house to look the way Maggie would like for it to look. So I said, okay. And I went to the house. I
Did you have a usual way that you went in to Moselle, entrance-wise?
From the house, I would, if I was coming from my house, I would come in on the, I call it the Miley's side. So I would actually enter the property through the kennels. And if I was coming from Hampton or if I, you know, in the other direction, then I would use the front entrance. But normally I use the kennel entrance coming from my house.
When you got to Moselle, we're now on the morning of June 8th, right, of 2021?
Yes, sir. Okay.
Did you see anybody in the property before you got to the main house?
No, sir.
And when you got to the main house, take us right there. Like right now as you're walking in the house, what were your observations?
It was hard because I know she wasn't going to be coming back. And I didn't want to move. I didn't want to move her stuff. It was just a weird feeling going through when I unlocked the front door to get in. It felt cold.
You really cared for her, didn't you?
I did.
What'd you do when you got inside?
When I got inside, I
I didn't turn on any lights. I didn't do anything. I walked through the front door and I went in the kitchen. And I was kind of, when I looked in the kitchen, I kind of just stopped in my tracks and I looked at the stove and I don't know what the word is. When I looked and I noticed the stove, that there was no pots on the stove, it was kind of unusual because usually when they ate dinner the night before, the pots usually stayed on the stove. Very, very seldom would she put, you know, certain meals in the refrigerator. A lot of times it was just left on the stove until the next day. And the pots were not in the sink and they were not on the stove. And then as I walked through, if you walk through the kitchen, like you're going to, from the kitchen, if you walk through the kitchen, if you go to the left, there's two, a freezer and a refrigerator, and the laundry room sat right there to the left. There's a back door to the back porch, and then there's the laundry room door. They're both right there. And as I turned to go to the laundry room, I noticed that there was, her pajamas were in the middle of the doorway, right in the middle, laid neatly in the middle of the doorway going into the laundry room. It was her pajama pants, a pair of underwear, and her pajama top.
Was that unusual?
That was very unusual.
Why?
Because she was
not to get too personal, but sometimes you can't help it. Were the underwear there with the pajamas unusual?
Yes.
Why?
She didn't wear underwear with her pajamas.
No underwear with pajamas. But that struck
you. No underclothes with the pajamas.
But that struck you as unusual, they were there with the pajamas.
Yes, sir, because the underwear appeared to be clean, not dirty. They still had like fold marks.
In the pots, and I may have just missed it. You said, where would the pots end up when you found them?
After I looked at the pajamas on the floor, the way that they were set, I turned around and I said, well, I wonder where the pots are. So I opened the refrigerator door and the pots were sitting inside the refrigerator with lids on them. And I was like, you know, who did this? I don't know at that point, but that was not normal for the whole pot to be sitting in the fridge.
Did you make any other observations in the house, the bathroom, or anywhere else?
In the master bathroom was her clothes were sitting next to the tub. It was a small pile of clothes right there next to the tub. By the shower, if you walk in the master bedroom, there's a big garden tub, spa type tub. And then right here is the shower, and there's a window. On the floor next to the shower was a slight puddle of water, a towel, and a pair of khaki pants. And then as I went to the left to see if there was anything else that was out, I looked in the closet, and in the closet was a white damp towel on the floor, and there was I'm pretty sure the t-shirt was white at one time, but you know, they get kind of dingy after a few years, but it appeared that a t-shirt had fallen off of the stack of t-shirts that were on top of the shelf right there in the closet. It was laying on the floor next to the towel.
Wait, you took care of the home. Was that, tell us how the clothes were laid out. The shirts, the shorts were, you're saying up on a shelf or the shirts?
In the closet, there was a shelf. There was some shelves, smaller shelves right here. And then there was some long ones. Maggie used to keep her clothes on these. And then there was a shorter one, kind of like little box looking, you know. Alex used to keep his clothes, his belts and stuff in that. And then on top, there was also an area where he kept t-shirts. They were folded and they were kept on the shelf.
And when you say t-shirts, I know what a t-shirt is, but I mean, were they t-shirts like I'm wearing
it
right now, or were they t-shirts with pockets?
It was usually,
was it?
They would be t-shirts, like if they would go, like when you go to a restaurant and they have like the logo of those type of t-shirts. He had a big collection of those.
And would you put them on the shelf?
Yes, sir, I did.
Did you iron t-shirt?
Yes, sir, I did.
And you washed all the clothes?
Yes, I did.
Did he have a certain place that he kept shorts versus long pants?
Yes, sir. When you walk in the master bedroom, when you enter the master bedroom, the bed was right here. At the foot of the bed, you had a dresser here and a dresser here. The right dresser on the top drawers were usually his underwear, his socks. The next drawer was his t-shirts. And the bottom drawer were the pajama pants that he would wear or his shorts that he would wear to sleep in. In the left drawer, and one sits on this side of the door going into the bathroom, and the other one's right here. On the left dresser, he kept his white t-shirts that he would wear under when he wore a suit. He would wear, the t-shirts were in one of those drawers. And then the other two drawers were shorts. The dressier shorts, and then the not so dressier shorts, you know that.
So you testified a shirt looked like it had fallen when you saw it this morning?
Yes, sir.
June 8th, 2021, okay. Was it still clean?
Yes, sir.
Did you put it back?
Yes, sir.
My boss, Don Zelenka, just reminded me that the food that you cooked, did you look and see how much was eaten in the pots?
No, sir, I did not.
Now, you said there was a damp towel. Where was that?
In the closet, on the floor.
Okay. And I know what damp means, but when you touched it, did it feel?
It was damp.
Okay. What did you do with it?
Took it to the laundry room.
And you said there were some pants there.
Yeah, so there's a pair of khakis by the shower.
And what'd you do with those?
Took them to the laundry room.
Did you wash them?
Yes, sir.
Can we go to the...
Ladies and gentlemen, let's stand for a moment. Please do not discuss the case.
That wraps up segment number one of our continuing coverage in the trial of Alec Murtaugh. Here on the 10th of February, 2023, day number 13 of continuing coverage. Stay with us. There's much more to come.